Well, if you look at today's handout, you will say that this is a long lesson, a big lesson, and it is. There's quite a bit of material to cover here. We're going to talk about the entire history of the northern nation of Israel. Okay? If you remember back a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the entire history of the United Kingdom of Israel, where all of Israel, all 12 tribes were together under one nation. And we saw that happened under three kings. We had Saul, then David, then Solomon. And then last week we talked about the role of the prophets in terms of calling the people back to God. That's what God wants, is a relationship with Him. These people were called to be blessings. They were blessed to be a blessing. That's the concept we keep reiterating over and over again in Bethel. Well, today we're going to see how that united kingdom became a divided kingdom and split between a northern kingdom called Israel and a southern kingdom called Judah. So today's lesson, we're going to talk about that northern kingdom called Israel and what happened to it. And then next week's lesson will be the southern kingdom of Judah and what happened to it. It likewise will be a very long study. A lot of ground to cover. In fact, the way that we're handling this in our classes is on Sunday mornings, we have split this class into two different lessons. Okay, the first half and the second half. Now, on Monday night, where we have a bit more time, we're covering all of this study in one class. So we'll see how we do on this recording here and how far we get. We may or may not read all of the verses as we go through, but I'll at least give you the gist of what's going on. There's a lot of really interesting stories, a lot of stories that you might have heard from your old Sunday school days. But there's also a lot of stories that you probably haven't heard and some interesting things that you might not really realize are there in the Bible. I would recommend, though, that if you haven't, take some time and read these stories. Very, very interesting. We're just going to zoom through because our focus in Bethel, again, is to look at the concepts, even though there's some interesting stories that we'll draw out in our talk today. But if you want to get deeper, I do recommend go to the BibleStoriesForAdults.com website and go to the Bible Stories for Adults study under the Old Testament, and you'll get to multiple studies there with more detail going over this material. Now, before we get into today's lesson, let us do remind ourselves a little bit about last week's lesson, the role of the prophet. So if you take a look at your picture for study number 14, Recalling a Destiny. Well, looking at this picture, the first things you see are these two guys. The first guy in the red robe is the prophet, okay, the prophet that God calls. And then the second figure in the tan robe or whatever is Israel, okay. And so we have the prophet that God called to go to Israel. And so we have multiple prophets, and we looked at a bunch of different prophets. And this is a common role of what the prophet was really all about. You take a look at the darkening sky in the background, and we're reminded that these prophets were called during tough times, during the age of decline of Israel, of Judah, of this nation that God had called, okay, during tough times. And if you look back on page 9 of today's handout, you'll see a chart showing you the different kings, but you'll also see where the prophets are. And you see the prophets don't show up, well, in the northern kingdom until the time of Ahab, which you'll see today is the bottom of the barrel time for the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom, we don't see the prophets popping up until the time of Jotham with Isaiah. But what pops up there is if you follow that over to the other side with Israel, that happens at the time that the northern nation's being destroyed. And that's a big part of what Isaiah was about, was to point to the southern nation of Judah saying, don't do what the northern nation's done, because this is what can happen to you. And we'll talk about that as we get there. But the point is that these prophets were called during tough times, during times when God was reaching out and really trying to call Israel back to Him. You take a look at Israel there, they're focused on the manuscript that you see tied to the anchor. And there's only a part of it left there. It says, I will bless you. And that's the part that Israel loved to focus on. They love that part. We love that part where God says, I will bless you. The rest of the manuscript we see is torn up and scattered all over the ground. And that reminds us that Israel had forgot the key part of the destiny, the other part, and that is that God was going to bless him so that they would be a blessing. Okay? They had a responsibility to be a blessing. The prophet, you see, is holding fragments of that manuscript before Israel's eyes, and that's what the prophet came to do, is to remind Israel of her destiny to be a blessing, being called by God. You see that Israel is clasping these mortar bowls and pestles. That's from our previous study on the uniting factors. And it reminds us that these uniting factors, these things that God put into place to unite them together, to hold them together, these traditions, rather than using them to be means to an end of being blessed to be a blessing, which is what God intended, Israel had turned them into ends in themselves. We talked about the Tent of Tabernacle, and they saw that the temple, they looked at the temple as a false reason for security. The law symbol, the law became a stumbling block to justice. The separation symbol, separation was turned into a curse. The circumcision symbol, the sharp rock, circumcision became a fetish. That's what they focused on, the circumcision, rather than what it was there to remind them about. The mirror symbol reminds us that they took the holy land that God, remember when Joshua came across and the angel told him to take his sandals off because the ground is holy ground? Well, they put it to unholy use. The yoke symbol, all their past history was glorified at the expense of their present and their future. Okay? So that's what we looked at last week. Now, let's see what happened. Okay, let's see what happened. If you remember back to our United Kingdom study the week before that, we had the three kings. The last king was Solomon. And the king before that was David. And remember the picture from there had the golden age. You know, you had this, the light coming down from above and the Star of David and the mace and the golden backdrop all above the throne of David, reminding us that that was the golden age for Israel. And then it declined with Solomon, right? Why was it the golden age for Israel? Because David was a man after God's heart. David lived in faith. And that's what we're going to see as we go through our studies this week and next, is that the quality of the king is a factor not of how well the people liked him, not based on the prosperity of the nation or the economic times or the warfare or lack of warfare or their successes and failures or any of that. What it was entirely dependent on was their relationship with God and how they led their nation to God or away from God. And so we see with David, he was considered the greatest king because he had a relationship with God and he led the nation into a relationship with God. Okay? Was he perfect? No. We see big problems with Bathsheba, etc. Was it a time of prosperity? Not really. Was it a time of warfare? Yes, it was. Okay? But it was the greatest time because it was a time where Israel was closest to God. With Solomon, though, how well did Solomon continue and emulate the faith of his father David? Turn to 1 Kings chapter 11. We'll start at verse 1. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonites, Sidonians and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Moloch, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. So we see that later on in his life, Solomon had a great start. And for most of his life, he had a good relationship with God. He built the temple. He looked to God. But as he got older and got settled in and looked at his own accomplishments rather than God's accomplishments and then married other wives, those wives led him astray, he worshiped other gods, and he fell away from God. Okay? And so he ended up not a good king. How did God respond to Solomon's faithlessness? Starting at verse 9 of that chapter. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, he forbid all people to follow other gods, right? Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, okay, he was a man after my heart, I will not do it during your lifetime. I'll tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David my servant. Not because of you, not because of him, but because of the relationship David my servant had, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. So, as a result of Solomon's falling away from God and following other gods, this dynasty that David had started, this dynasty of faith, would go away. And God was going to pull the kingdom away from David's family, away from Solomon's family. However, for the sake of David, he was going to leave a remnant. He was going to leave a piece, one tribe. Okay, 10 tribes would go, and one tribe would be left. We'll talk about that in just a bit. So, to whom did God choose to give the rest of Israel? Chapter 11, verse 28 to 32. Now, Jeroboam was a man of standing, and when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the house of Joseph. About that time, Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah, the prophet of Shiloh, met him on the way wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Then he said to Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I'm going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David, in the city of Jerusalem, which I've chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. So this man named Jeroboam, who was just an up-and-coming star in Solomon's kingdom, that Solomon promoted to higher positions, God had chosen him and was going to give him the northern 10 tribes. Now, if you look, it says he was going to give Jeroboam 10 tribes, but Rehoboam, who was Solomon's son, would have one tribe. Well, 10 plus 1 does not quite equal 12, does it? Well, kind of it does. If you take a look at a map, and I didn't give you one to look at here, but if you look at a map, you will see that the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Simeon are together. Simeon is completely engulfed by Judah, so that by this time, Simeon and Judah kind of were together. And so that's the one tribe that's really two tribes that is going to be the southern nation of Judah. All right, what instructions were given to this new king-elect? Verse 38. If you do whatever I command you and walk in my ways and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and commands, as David my servant did, then I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one that I built for David, and will give Israel to you. So the same promise that God had made to Saul, the same promise God had made to David, that he had made to Solomon, he now is making to Jeroboam. He says, I'm calling you to lead my people. And if you have a right relationship with me and lead these people in a right relationship with me, then I will bless you and you will continue to be a blessing. Okay, I will bless you with a dynasty that endures forever, just like I've given to David. Okay, so he's given this great, great promise. All right. Well, what happened to Jeroboam after Solomon heard what happened? Verse 40, Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt to Shishak, the king, and stayed there until Solomon's death. Okay, so he ran away to Egypt. until Solomon died. And then after Solomon died, who took over? Verse 42. Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over Israel for 40 years. Then he rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, his father. And Rehoboam, his son, succeeded him as king. Okay? So Solomon's son Rehoboam became the next king. So now what happens? Well, he's the king of this united nation, the united kingdom of Israel. Word of that gets out, and so now it's up to the people. Do we agree that he's our king? We've seen before, like Samuel had presented to the people, this is Saul, your new king. Well, they came back later and confirmed that and said, yes, he's our king. Well, that's what needs to happen now too, is that these people need to pledge their allegiance to this new king. So, they gather together. They gather together and the people of Israel come to him and say, okay, we'll follow you if. And what is that if? Chapter 12, verse 2. Mm-hmm. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard that Solomon had died, he was still in Egypt where he had fled from King Solomon, he returned from Egypt. So the people of Israel sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and heavy yoke that he put on us, and we will serve you. We talked about that with Solomon. You remember our picture on the United Kingdom, that his throne had attached to it a yoke, and a yoke dealing with the heavy taxation and the forced labor that Solomon instituted against his own people. Well, the Israelites then came to Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and said, hey, we'll follow you if you lighten the load. Reduce the taxes, stop this forced labor, stop making slaves out of your own people, and we will follow you. Well, Rehoboam went back and said, hey, give me 3 days to talk about it, to think about it. And he talked to the elders that had served his father Solomon. He also then talked to his old buddies, his friends. And what did he decide to do? How did he respond to the request? Verse 13. The king answered the people harshly. Rejecting the advice given him by the elders, he followed the advice of the young men and said, my father made your yoke heavy. I'm going to make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I'll scourge you with scorpions. So the king did not listen to the people, for this turn of events was from the Lord to fulfill the word that the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through Ahijah the Shilonite. So Rehoboam took the poor advice of the young aides and said that he would add the load. Well, how do they respond to that? How do the northern tribes handle this response that Rehoboam gave him? Verse 20, when all the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all of Israel. Only the tribe of Judah remained loyal to the house of David. So Jeroboam was then made king by all the nations of Israel. They said, okay, Rehoboam's going to make it tougher on us. Well, we don't want that, so to heck with you. We'll go find our own king. And they went to Jeroboam. And Jeroboam became king that confirmed what Ahijah the prophet had said would happen, what God had said would happen. Well, Rehoboam was going to be king over this entire United Kingdom. And all of a sudden, 10/12 of it is pulled away from him. How does he react to that? What is this? This is civil war. Does he just stand back and say, okay, oh well, at least I've got one? No, this is civil war. He's the king. He needs to fight this civil war. So that's what he does. He tries to take back the 10 tribes by force. And what happens? Verse 22. Well, I'll start at verse 21. When Rehoboam arrived in Jerusalem, he mustered the whole house of Judah and tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 fighting men, to make war against the house of Israel and to regain the kingdom for Rehoboam, son of Solomon. But this word of God came to Shemaiah, the man of God. Say to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah, to the whole house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the rest of the people, this is what the Lord says. Do not go up to fight against your brothers, the Israelites. Go home, every one of you, for this is my doing. So God sent a prophet to him and say, hey, don't go fight this battle. God made this happen. Well, gosh, he's lost his whole kingdom almost. Is he going to accept that? That does stand out for me at least. Take a look at the rest of that verse here. So they obeyed the word of the Lord and went home again as the Lord had ordered. So there you do see, even though the guy made a bad decision and didn't listen to the good advice of the elders and listened to the stupid advice of his young friends, he still sought God and he recognized God's calling, that God was in the midst of this, and he didn't fight God against it. And so he stopped and did not go and attack and fight against the northern tribes to try to take them back. Okay? So now we have two nations. We have the southern nation of Judah, which we'll talk about next week, and we have the northern nation of Israel. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Now let's talk, before we get into the kings, let's just kind of give a little overview of this northern nation. Okay? Well, for one thing, where was the capital? Where was the capital of Israel? Well, 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 21, we see that Rehoboam was made king in Judah. He was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city that the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel in which to put his name. So God had chosen Jerusalem. When David set up Jerusalem as the political and the religious capital for Israel, he did so at God's choosing. And God, and you'll see it over and over again, Jerusalem is referred to as the city where God has placed his name. Well, Jerusalem, though, is now part of Judah, the southern nation. The northern nation of Israel, though, Jerusalem is not part of them. So they need their own capital. So where do they settle their capital? Well, actually, there's multiple answers to that. We start out in 1 Kings 12:25 that we see that Jeroboam fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. Okay? So Shechem is where Jeroboam first started out his national capital, the national capital of Israel. But we see that before he finished being king, he moved it. And it doesn't directly say it, but we get it from multiple verses. And I'll just pull out a couple of them here. Chapter 14, verse 17, we see that Jeroboam's wife got up and left and went to Tirzah. Okay, she went to Tirzah. And we see that in 15, verse 33, that in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, son of Ahijah, became king of all Israel in Tirzah. Okay, and the point of all this is that Jeroboam, during his kingship, moved the capital, the national capital, from Shechem to Tirzah, which really isn't very far away, but he moved it. We then see later on in chapter 16 that it gets moved again. And you know, we're talking about dozens of years, 100 years, whatever. So as time goes on, people, in fact, you can look at the actual timeline on page 10. You can see the years of all this stuff. But eventually in chapter 16, we see that in the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, Omri became king of Israel, and he reigned 12 years, six of them in Tirzah. Now, while he was in Tirzah, so there we still see Tirzah as being the capital, and Omri comes a few kings later, that if you look back on page 10, you see you had Jeroboam, then Nadab, and then Baasha, Elah, Zimri, and then Omri. Okay, so Omri started out in Tirzah, but it says in verse 24 that he bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer for 2 talents of silver and built a city on the hill, calling it Samaria after Shemer, the name of the former owner of the hill. Okay, Shemaria, Samaria, that's what he called it there. So he bought and basically made his own city called Shemaria, okay, or Samaria. And then verse 29, in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria over Israel for 22 years. So we see then that the first 6 years of Omri were in Tirzah, and then he created this new city called Samaria and moved it there. One other thing about this northern nation of Israel It was called the Nation of Israel. You'll also hear it referred to as the Nation of Samaria. Okay? Not because there was a Nation of Samaria, but that was their state capital. That was their national capital, Samaria. And the people of the region being called Samaritans. And we hear that in the New Testament. And a little bit of background about that, because the Samaritans, in fact, let's jump ahead. How did the Israelites, how did the Jews feel about the Samaritans? If you look forward to John, this is just one out of many examples in the New Testament here, but John chapter 4, verse 9, this is Jesus as he's gone through Samaria and he gets talking with this woman at a well, the Samaritan woman. And in verse 9 it says, the Samaritan woman said to him, "You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Okay? So the question is why? What's the deal here? Is it because there was a rivalry or an animosity between the younger, or between the southern Jews and the northern Israelites? Not really, because by the time of Jesus, there were no Israelites in those northern areas. And that all happens at the end of today's lesson. And what we see, if you look back on page 10, you see all these kings. You see the kings stopped there around 734 BC of the northern kingdom. It just stopped because that nation ceases to exist. Why? Well, it's all described in 2 Kings chapter 17, how it all summed up. But let me just give you the final bottom line here. It says, in starting in verse 22, that the Israelites persisted in all the sins of Jeroboam and did not turn away from them until the Lord removed them from his presence, as he had warned through all his servants, the prophets. So the people of Israel were taken from their homeland into exile in Assyria, and they're still there. Not only were they taken into Assyria, but they were scattered throughout Assyria, and they ceased to exist as a people. They assimilated with the other peoples there, so they stopped existing as a people. Verse 24 then, the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, Sepharvaim, and settled them in the towns of Samaria to replace the Israelites. They took over Samaria and lived in its towns. So the people then who lived in Samaria, the people who lived in the towns and the cities of the northern nation of Israel, were no longer Israelites. They were all these other peoples that the Assyrians had conquered. And just like they took the Israelites and scattered them throughout their empire, they took other people that they conquered and scattered them, some of them, into Israel. Okay? And then verse 29, we see that nevertheless, each national group made its own gods in the several towns where they settled, and they set them up in the shrines that the people of Samaria had made at the high places. And then verse 41, even while these people were worshiping Yahweh, the Lord, they were serving their idols. To this day, their children and grandchildren continue to do as their fathers did. So why did the Jews at Jesus' time hate the Samaritans? Because they were not part of God's people. They were not Israelites. They were people from other peoples living in the land of Israel. And what got the Jews the most, because Jews had other non-Jews, other non-Israelites on other borders, but these people were taught a little bit about how to worship Yahweh, and we'll see that that was a very polluted form of understanding who Yahweh is and worshiping Yahweh. And they thought that, hey, we worship the same God that you do, but they didn't. They worshiped lots of gods. So there was a big difference between Samaritans and Israelites. The northern nations of Israel, they ceased to exist. These lost tribes of Israel, they're not just lost, they're gone. And we'll talk more about that as we get further into the study. Okay? So that's a little future history about where we're going here in this lesson. Now, Jeroboam, he's now king. Okay? Number one, he has to set up his new capital, so he does that in Shechem and then moves it to Tirzah. Well, that takes care of the political stuff, but what about the religious stuff? I mean, these are God's people. They're going to want to go to Jerusalem to worship God. Where's Jerusalem? It's there in Judah, in the southern nation. So Jeroboam doesn't want his people looking to Jerusalem as being God's place and where they need to go, because they could turn on him. Okay? They'll have their allegiance towards Jerusalem, towards Judah, towards Rehoboam. So what does he do to keep his people, the Israelites, from going to Jerusalem for worship? 1 Kings chapter 12, starting at verse 26. Jeroboam thought to himself, "The kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David. If these people go up to offer their sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they'll again give their allegiance to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. They'll kill me and they'll return to King Rehoboam." So after seeking advice, the king made two golden calves. He said to the people, "It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. One he set in Bethel and the other in Dan." And this thing became a sin. The people went even as far as Dan to worship the one there. So what did he do? He made up his own religion. He made golden calves. He made idols. He said, "These are your gods. Don't go to Jerusalem and worship that Yahweh God. These are your gods that brought you up out of Egypt." And he set up these golden calves. He set up these temples. He did one in Bethel. Okay? We've heard of Bethel a lot. Bethel's not far after they came into the Promised Land, not far from Ai, right? Bethel is where Jacob had the stairway to heaven, and he called that the house of God. That's what Bethel means. A lot of history there. He sets up this pagan temple for this pagan religion, this man-made religion, for the Israelites to worship these idols there. And then he also does another one way up north in Dan, okay, which is way up north past the Sea of Galilee. So that people living up there could go to that one, and people down south could go to the one in Bethel. And he didn't stop there. Going on, verse 31, Jeroboam built shrines on high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. He instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the festival held in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. This he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. At Bethel, he also installed priests at the high places he had made. On the 15th day of the 8th month, a month of his own choosing, he offered sacrifices on the altar that he built at Bethel. So he instituted the festival for the Israelites and went up to the altar to make offerings. So what did he do? He built shrines on high places and he created festivals. He made up this religion and put people in as priests and just... It's his own religion. It has nothing to do with Yahweh and worshiping Yahweh. Look at chapter 13, verse 33. It says, "Even after this, Jeroboam did not change his evil ways, but once more appointed priests for the high places from all sorts of people. Anyone who wanted to become a priest, he consecrated for the high places. This was the sin of the house of Jeroboam that led to its downfall and to its destruction from the face of the earth." So he appointed all sorts of people as priests, not Levites, just anybody who wanted to be a priest, you come be a priest. Okay? What he did here by creating this new religion, this anti-Yahweh, anti-God religion, set things in place that resulted in the downfall and the elimination and the destruction of the northern nation of Israel. Now what's also interesting is what we see in the Chronicles, verses that parallel this, okay? The books, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, parallel the Samuel and Kings books, where Chronicles focuses more so on the southern nation of Judah, but obviously refers to some of the stuff that's going on in the north as well. And if we look at 2nd Chronicles 11, starting at verse 13, we see that the priests and Levites from all their districts throughout Israel sided with Rehoboam. The Levites even abandoned their pasture lands and property and came to Judah and Jerusalem because Jeroboam and his sons had rejected them as priests of the Lord. And he appointed his own priests for the high places and for the goat and calf idols that he had made. Those from every tribe of Israel who set their hearts on seeking the Lord, the God of Israel, they followed the Levites to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices to the Lord, the God of their fathers. They strengthened the kingdom of Judah and supported Rehoboam, son of Solomon, 3 years, walking in the ways of David and Solomon during this time. So because of Jeroboam making up this religion, the faithful people in Israel, in the northern nation of Israel, they saw what was happening and they left. They left and they went down to Judah. And that strengthened the southern nation of Judah. in terms of his relationship with God. And so now we see that the northern nation of Israel has turned away from God because of this man-made religion, and the people that would try to redirect that nation back to God have left, and they're down in Judah. So that sets up a stage that creates problems for the rest of the time of this nation. And what we see over and over and over and over and over again with each of these kings, let me just read you some of these verses here. Chapter 15, verse 26. It says, Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, became king, and he did evil in the eyes of the Lord, walking in the ways of his father Jeroboam and in his sin that he had caused Israel to commit. So Jeroboam had started this sin. He led Israel into this sin. He caused Israel to commit this sin of rejection of God and worshiping these idols. And his son Nadab, who took over for him, followed in his footsteps and continued that sin. But not only him. Verse 34, it talks about the next king, Baasha. He did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, walking in the sins of Jeroboam and in his sin which he had caused Israel to commit. Sounds familiar, right? Okay. And then, let's look at another one, 16 verse 19. It's going to sound familiar. It's talking about Zimri, did evil in the eyes of the Lord and walked in the ways of Jeroboam and in the sin he had committed and caused Israel to commit. Then verse 26. Omri walked in all the ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and in his sin which he had caused Israel to commit, so that they provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their worthless idols, etc., etc. You just keep going on. And so what you see is this continues on and on and on, and you see that for every king, they continued in the sins that Jeroboam had started. Never do we see a king in the northern nation that returns fully to God. If you take a look at the chart on page 10, you see, for the northern nation of Israel, you've got the king, how many years they ruled, and then what their rule was like. You see bad, 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 then extra bad, then the worst, then bad, bad mostly. Okay, bad mostly means there's a little positive element there, and we'll talk about that when we get there. But you see, they're all bad. Never do we see good or faithful or any of that, which we'll see when we talk about the southern nation of Judah. They all persisted in the sins of Jeroboam. They all kept those idols there in Dan and Bethel and worshiped those idols and led Israel to worship those idols. Okay? So it created a big problem for Israel that, as a result, we see in 2 Kings chapter 17 that summarizes what happened to that nation. When he tore Israel away from the house of David, they made Jeroboam, son of Nebat, their king. Jeroboam enticed Israel away from following the Lord and caused them to commit a great sin. The Israelites persisted in all the sins of Jeroboam and did not turn away from them until Yahweh removed them from his presence, as he had warned through all his servants the prophets. So the people of Israel were taken from their homeland into exile into Assyria, and they're still there. Okay? So God removed them from his presence into exile in Assyria, where they ceased to exist as a nation as a result of their continued rejection of him by following the gods that Jeroboam had implemented. Okay? So there's your common theme. That's what you're going to see as we go through these kings of the northern kingdom. Now, you'll also see a standard format as we look at the stories in 1 Kings and 2 Kings. For each king, it'll start out saying, in the blank year of so-and-so, the king of Judah. Okay? What we have in these books are the stories of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, both. And the writers try to keep it chronological, so it's bouncing back and forth a lot between stories about the king of Israel and then stories about the king of Judah and stories about the king of Israel and stories about the king of Judah, back and forth to where it's kind of confusing. And so that's part of why we are taking these and looking at the northern kings first, and then we'll look at the southern kings next week to help separate that. But since they didn't have this calendar based on the year of how many years since Jesus was born, or like we have today, they refer to so-and-so became king in the 14th year of so-and-so, the king of Judah. Okay? And then when we talk about the king of Judah, he became king of Judah in the whatever year of so-and-so, the king of Israel. So that you have those connections that way. All right? Then you'll see details about the king and the length of his reign and where he reigned as king. And then it'll say, and you'll see this over and over, he did evil in the eyes of the Lord and walked in the way of Jeroboam and his sin, which he caused Israel to commit. Then it concludes by saying, now the rest of the acts of so-and-so, are they not recorded or not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And then often you'll have a final statement that says that he slept with his fathers and that so-and-so reigned in his stead. Okay, who the next king was. All right, so you'll see that pattern as we go through this. Now, let's take a look at our picture for today. And if you look at our picture, it kind of is in the shape to a degree of the nation of Israel, but that's not what's intended here. What's intended, though, is you've got a chronological view starting at the top and working its way down of the different kings of the nation of Israel. Now, if you take a look, there's three main colors of these kings that you see. You've got this dark area at the top, okay? Then there's a golden area, and then there's a red, orange and red area. The top area, the dark section of crumbling earth, this refers to a time of civil strife, a period of civil strife. Okay, what do we have? Well, we've got a civil war, right? You've got Jeroboam, who took the bulk of the nation of Israel and left just a little part of it with Rehoboam. So you've got this civil strife, and just because Rehoboam didn't immediately attack Jeroboam to get those nations, the tribes back, because God told him not to, doesn't mean that others didn't try to do so in the future. And so we have a lot of civil strife during this time between the northern and southern kingdoms. Then the golden section, we see that we have a time of wealth and prosperity. Now that's wealth and prosperity. That's an economical kind of thing. It doesn't have anything to do with their relationship with God, though. And we'll see that some of the worst times are right around that time as well. And then you've got the orange to red area, and that's the age of rapid decline. Age of rapid decline. We'll see that as we get there. All right, so let's start talking about some of these kings. The first one we see at the upper left is Jeroboam. We've already been talking about Jeroboam. And you see on his, you see a golden calf. What does that tell us? That reminds us that Jeroboam established his own religious shrines, his temples, his own religion at Dan and Bethel. Okay, so that's what we remember when we see that golden calf there. Now, we were reading before how he set up these temples and altars, and he, at the end of chapter 12, he was going to make these sacrifices on the altar. And at that time, God sends a prophet, a man of God, to come and prophesy to Jeroboam about that altar. And we see that in chapter 13. By the word of the Lord, a man of God came from Judah to Bethel as Jeroboam was standing by the altar to make an offering. He cried out against the altar by the word of the Lord. Oh, altar, altar, this is what the Lord says. A son named Josiah will be born to the house of David. On you he will sacrifice the priests of the high places who now make offerings there. And human bones will be burned on you. That same day the man of God gave a sign. This is the sign the Lord has declared. The altar will be split apart and the ashes on it will be poured out. Okay, so he gave a curse against that altar. He said that a descendant of David named Josiah would come and defile that altar by burning human bones and that kind of thing on that altar. And we see way back in 2 Kings chapter 23, okay, turn back to 2 Kings chapter 23, we see the fulfillment of that. Now, if you look on page 10, you see Josiah isn't until 638 B.C., and right now we're with Jeroboam, it's like 930 B.C., so we're talking hundreds of years here. But hundreds of years later, what happens? 2 Kings chapter 23, starting at verse 15. Even the altar at Bethel, the high place made by Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who had caused Israel to sin, even that altar and high place Josiah demolished. He burned the high place and ground it to powder and burned the Asherah pole also. Then Josiah looked around and he saw the tombs that were there on the hillside. He had the bones removed from them and burned on the altar to defile it in accordance with the word that the Lord had proclaimed by the man of God who had foretold these things. The king asked, "What's that tombstone I see?" The men of the city said, "It marks the tomb of the man of God who came from Judah and pronounced against the altar of Bethel the very things that you've done to it." "Well, leave it alone," he said. "Don't let anyone disturb his bones." So they spared his bones and those of the prophet who had come from Samaria. Okay. Oh, a little bit more. Just as he had done at Bethel, Josiah removed and defiled all the shrines at the high places that the kings of Israel had built in the towns of Samaria that had provoked the Lord to anger. Josiah slaughtered all the priests of those high places on the altars and burned human bones on them, and then he went back to Jerusalem. So we see, hundreds of years later, what had been foretold was done. What had been foretold happened. Okay? So, we've got Jeroboam. He's made this religion. Is God just going to let that happen? Well, God sends a prophet, Ahijah. Okay, so we do have prophets early on here because it's a downtime and God needs to reach out here. And he sends this guy named Ahijah in chapter 14 to Jeroboam. And what does he say? Ahijah says, because of this, I'm going to bring disaster on the house of Jeroboam. I will cut off from Jeroboam every last male in Israel, slave or free. I will burn up the house of Jeroboam as one burns dung until it's all gone. So Ahijah, God sent the word through Ahijah to tell Jeroboam that because of his rejection of him, because of him leading Israel astray, Jeroboam and his family was going to be wiped out, gone. Okay, history. All of his males would be cut off. Okay. We'll see that happen as we go on. Now, one last note. Okay, we're talking about this is a period of civil strife. We see that in verse 30. It says, there was continual warfare between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. So all during this time of Jeroboam, there was always a lot of strife, warfare, trouble between Israel and Judah. Okay, they were enemies. All right, that was Jeroboam. He ruled for 22 years, and then he was followed by Nadab. Who was Nadab and how faithful was his reign? Chapter 15, verse 25. Okay, now the verses that we're skipping are talking about kings of Judah. We'll cover those next week. Okay, so we go to verse 25, and we see that Nadab, son of Jeroboam, became king of Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah, and he reigned over Israel for 2 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, walking in the ways of his father and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit. So there you see that pattern I told you about, how you see that same pattern with each of the kings. But we see Nadab was Jeroboam's son, and he became the next king. How long did he reign? Only 2 years. We see how faithful was he? Not at all. He followed the sins of his father Jeroboam. Now, why did he only serve 2 years? Well, let's go further. Verse 27, the next verse. Baasha, the son of Ahijah of the house of Issachar, plotted against him, Nadab. And he struck him down at Gibbethon, a Philistine town, while Nadab and all of Israel were besieging it. Baasha killed Nadab in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and succeeded him as king. As soon as he began to reign, he killed Jeroboam's whole family. He did not leave Jeroboam anyone that breathed, but destroyed them all according to the word of the Lord given through his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. So this guy named Baasha goes and attacks Nadab while he's busy fighting against and besieging a town of the Philistines, and Baasha then becomes king. Okay, Baasha becomes king, and what does he do? First thing he does is he wipes out all of Jeroboam's family. So just as Ahijah the prophet had said, Jeroboam's family would be no more, and Baasha carries that out. Okay. All right, well, how faithful was his reign? Verse 34. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, walking in the ways of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit. Okay? Sound familiar? It's going to continue to be familiar to you. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. All of Israel's kings were evil. Well, so as a result, we saw the judgment that God gave against Jeroboam for him leading Israel astray and keeping them worshiping his gods rather than Yahweh. Does God have a similar judgment against Baasha? Chapter 16, verse 3. Well, I'm going to start at verse 1. Then the word of the Lord came to Jehu, son of Hanani, against Baasha. I lifted you up from the dust and I made you leader of my people Israel. But you walked in the ways of Jeroboam and caused my people of Israel to sin and to provoke me to anger by their sins. So, I'm about to consume Baasha and his house. and I will make your house like that of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. The same judgment that God had proclaimed against Jeroboam, he's going to do to Baasha and wipe out Baasha's family. Okay. All right. Well, let's see. What was the relationship we saw that with Jeroboam? His family had civil strife against Judah, the southern nation. What about how was the relationship between Israel and Judah during Baasha's reign? Chapter 15, verse 16. There was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, throughout their reigns. Okay, so you have continued civil strife. We do see that during that time, they retook Bethel. Okay, way back in 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 30, when there was warfare between Rehoboam and Jeroboam, Jeroboam lost Bethel to Abijah. We see that in 2 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 19. Okay, Abijah being Rehoboam's son, the next king after Rehoboam of Judah. Well, now during the time of Asa and Baasha, Baasha took Bethel back, and so Bethel then became back part of the northern nation of Israel. Okay, just kind of a little side note there for you. Now, that was a gain for Israel, and Bethel was very important to them because that's where one of their temples was. But there was also a significant loss that Israel experienced because of this civil strife. We see that in verse 20 of chapter 15. Now, actually, I'll go a little bit further back because Asa took all the silver and gold, this is certain verse 18, that was left in the treasuries of the Lord's temple in his own palace, and he entrusted it to his officials and sent them to Ben-Hadad, the son of Tabrimon, the son of Hezion, the king of Aram, okay, that is Syria, who was ruling in Damascus. Let there be a treaty between me and you as there was between my father and your father. See, I'm sending you a gift of silver and gold. Now break your treaty with Baasha, king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from me. Ben-Hadad agreed with King Asa and sent the commanders of his forces against the towns of Israel. He conquered Ijon, Dan, okay, Dan is where that other temple was. So they regained Bethel, but now they've lost Dan. Abel-Meth-Ma'akah, and all of Kinnereth, in addition to Naphtali, the whole tribe area of Naphtali. Okay, so Syria attacked and conquered. Syria allied themselves with the southern nation of Judah against the northern nation of Israel, and then came and took a lot of the territory of Israel, including Naphtali, the tribal area of Naphtali, and the city of Dan, which is where they had their other temple. All right, that was Baasha. He reigned for 24 years, and then he was followed by Elah. And who was that, and how faithful was his reign? Chapter 16, verse 8. In the 26th year of Asa, king of Judah, Elah, son of Baasha, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Tirzah for 2 years. Okay, for 2 years. Now it says that there were all the sins that Baasha and his son Elah had committed and caused Israel to commit, so that they provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their worthless idols. Okay, so Baasha's son Elah took over, and he committed sins and caused Israel to commit sins just like his father, that is, following the gods of Jeroboam, not following Yahweh. Now, he only lasted for 2 years. Why not? Well, you've got this prophecy from Jehu to Baasha that says that his family is going to be wiped out, and we see that happen starting at verse 9. It says, Zimri, one of his officials, that's one of Elah's officials, okay, who had command of half of his chariots, plotted against him. Elah was in Tirzah at the time, getting drunk in the home of Arza, the man in charge of the palace at Tirzah. Zimri came in, struck him down, and killed him in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, and then he succeeded him as king. As soon as he began to reign and was seated on the throne, he killed off Baasha's whole family. He did not spare a single male, whether relative or friend. So Zimri destroyed the whole family of Baasha in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken against Baasha through the prophet Jehu. Okay. So Zimri took care of the dirty deed of wiping out Baasha's family, confirming the word of God through Jehu. Okay. Now we see that Zimri only was king for 7 days. You see that on your hand out there. Why? What happened there? Well, we see that the next king is Omri. We see that starting in verse 21, but we see some of the story already as we look at the story of Zimri that begins in verse 15. So let's look at some of this. In the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, Zimri reigned in Tirzah for 7 days. It's a busy 7 days because he wiped out Baasha's family during that time. And then we also see that the army was encamped near Gibbethon, a Philistine town. When the Israelites in the camp heard that Zimri had plotted against the king and murdered him, they proclaimed Omri, the commander of the army, king over Israel that very day there in the camp. Okay, so the army hears that the king has been assassinated, that Ella's been assassinated by this guy named Tirzah. Well, they don't want to follow Tirzah. They like their commander. And so they proclaim the commander of the army, Omri, to be the king. Okay? Well, this is the military, and the military's got the power, so they can do something about it, right? So what do? Verse 17, then Omri and all the Israelites with him withdrew from Gibbethon and laid siege to Tirzah. So they go to their own national capital and lay siege to it, okay, because Zimri's in there. When Zimri saw that the city was taken, he went into the citadel, the royal palace, and set the palace on fire around him. So he died. Okay? So Zimri killed himself by burning the palace around him. Well, this may tell you a little bit about why Omri decided to go build a new city and built Samaria and made a new palace there, because the palace here had been destroyed by Zimri. Okay. All right. Now, what's also interesting here is that Omri wasn't the only one who thought he should be king. Take a look at verse 21. Then the people of Israel were split into two factions. Half supported Timni, son of Ginath, for king, and the other half supported Omri. And then verse 22 is interesting. But Omri's followers proved stronger than those of Timni, son of Ginath. So, Timni died, and Omri became king. I love how that verse puts it. So, Timni died. You know, it's just kind of a matter of fact. Okay? Omri was stronger, so Timni died, and Omri became king. So, is this the way that God wants his kings to be chosen? No. When we talked about the United Kingdom, how were the kings to be chosen? They were to be chosen by God, not by succession. Okay? Where Ella, Baasha's son, became king, okay? Not by force or coup, not by assassination, the way Zimri did it, not by fighting, the way Omri did it, okay? So lots and lots of problems in this northern nation of Israel. Well, how faithful was Omri's reign? Chapter 16, verse 25. But Omri did evil in the eyes of the Lord and sinned more than all those before him. Okay, he walked in all the ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and the sin which he'd caused Israel to commit. But he was even worse than Jeroboam. He was worse than Baasha. He was worse than all of those that were before him. Okay, so Omri was worse than the others. And you would say, well, he was the worst. Well, he's the worst so far. If you take a look at the chart on page 10, we see he's extra bad, okay? Because you see his son, the next one, which we're going to talk about in just a second, Ahab, was the worst. Now, what did Omri change that led to a name given to the northern kingdom? We've already talked about this. Verse 24, we see that he bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer for 2 talents of silver and built a city on the hill, calling it Samaria after Shemer, the name of the former owner of the hill. Okay? So we have Samaria being formed there. Now we also have, if you look at our picture on Omri, you've got this volcano there, and the volcano reminds us that during Omri's reign, Syria threatened Israel's freedom. Okay, and actually, Syria threatened Israel's freedom from Baasha's time on through Omri. Okay, so Baasha, Ella, and Omri. And you also see the coins there that remind us that they had to pay tribute. They were subject to Syria at that time. All right, the next one, Ahab. Ahab. Who was Ahab? How faithful was his reign? Verse 29, in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria over Israel for 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him, and I would say also than any of those after him. He was the worst. He not only, this is interesting here, he not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, okay? Oh, that stuff Jeroboam's been doing is nothing. Let me show you how I can really screw up God here, right? But he also married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than did all the kings of Israel before him. Boy, he really took it downhill quick. And he took it to the bottom. To the bottom. And really, a lot of it, and you'll see as we get into Ahab, Ahab really was a wimpy kind of person. The one who wore the pants in that family was his wife Jezebel. Okay, we can see some parallels in our own kind of governments at times too, but Jezebel was what created all the problems, and Ahab didn't stand up to her. Ahab supported her, and Ahab supported this Baal worship, and they worshiped not only Jeroboam's gods, but they worshiped Baal. And Baal was the main god, and Asherah poles, and just what we were talking about before, about the detestable gods that the Canaanites and Amorites and all the various et ceterites worshiped and how they worshiped them, now that becomes part of the worship of Israel. God had told the Israelites to go wipe all those people out so that they won't be thorns in your flesh, so that they won't tempt you to go astray, that they won't lead you astray from me. And now, you see, it gets fully integrated into the northern nation of Israel to where they are the Baal-worshipping people. We see it so bad that chapter 18, verses 3 to 4, we see that there's Obadiah, who is in charge of Ahab's palace. Obadiah was a devout believer in Yahweh, and while Jezebel was killing off Yahweh's prophets, Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them in two caves, 50 in each, and supplied them with food and water. So here we see Jezebel not only was promoting Baal worship, but she was doing everything she could to get rid of anything having to do with Yahweh, killing off all of Yahweh's prophets. And this Obadiah guy, at risk of his own life, saved 100 Yahweh prophets from Jezebel. Chapter 21, verses 25 to 26 kind of really summarizes it here. It says, "There was never a man like Ahab, who sold himself to do evil in the eyes of Yahweh, urged on by Jezebel his wife. He behaved in the vilest manner by going after idols, like the Amorites the Lord drove out before Israel." There was never anyone like him. Never anyone as evil in God's eyes as Ahab. This was the bottom of the barrel. You take a look at our picture, the darkest time. You take a look at Ahab's piece of the crumbling north here, and it's the darkest there. Now you see some things on there. First, you see that snake. The snake points us to Baalism. Okay, points us to worship of other gods. And Baalism, the Baalism cult gained a solid foothold in Israel during Ahab's reign, and that's what that snake reminds us of. Now we also see a couple of banners. A couple of major banners. These are major prophets. These are prophets. When we see these banners on here, we talk about the prophets here. And you've got Elijah and Elisha. So the prophets of Elijah and Elisha came during this time of Baalism in the northern kingdom. So God sent his heavy hitters of Elijah and Elisha during this dark, bottom of the barrel days of Israel. Okay, Elijah came during the time of Ahab, and Elisha came after Elijah then left. And now you see that these these banners are black and white, and that kind of points out part of the role of the prophet of giving the doom, the gloom, the warning. It says if you continue on the way this is happening, God's going to punish you. Okay, but the white reminds us of the hope. So you've got sin, judgment, grace, right? Because of your sin, we've got the black, we've got God's judgment, God's wrath, God's what you deserve for this. the punishment that will come as a result of your sin. But God being a just, that's God being a just God, God being a merciful and a loving God, offers His grace even though you don't deserve it. And the prophets brought that message as well. So by looking at those two colors, the black and the white, that reminds us of the doom and the hope that the prophets brought. Now, during the time of Ahab, oh, lots of stories, lots and lots of stories. One short one here in verse 34 of chapter 16 is interesting. In Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho. Okay, remember Jericho was destroyed by Joshua and the Israelites under Joshua, actually destroyed by God. And at that destruction, Joshua gave a curse that said, "Cursed be anybody who ever tries to rebuild this city. And if they do, may they do so at the cost of their oldest son and the cost of their youngest son." Well, look what happens here. Hiel laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn son, Abiram, and he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segub, in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken by Joshua, son of Nun. When else would you expect that to happen? God had destroyed Jericho and said, no one should ever rebuild this. Cursed be anyone who does. Under whose time would you expect someone to do something? During Ahab's time. And that's when it happened. Okay? And the curse came through, even though that was hundreds of years before. Now, that was back in Joshua 6, verse 26. You see that kind of on your note there of the reference to that. Now, even though Ahab completely and totally rejected Yahweh, Yahweh did not completely and totally reject Ahab and did not completely and totally reject his people, Israel. They were his people. And take a look in 1 Kings chapter 20 that God supports Ahab here. Look, verse 1, Ben-Hadad, by the way, Ben-Hadad just means son of Hadad or son of, that's kind of another phrase for God for the Syrians, and that was a common title. So we read about another Ben-Hadad, so it's not like it was just a popular name. That was kind of the title, kind of like Pharaoh of Egypt and Caesar for Rome, that kind of thing. So Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, mustered his entire army. Accompanied by 32 kings with their horses and chariots, he went up and besieged Samaria and attacked it. Okay, so the Syrians, the Arameans, come and attack Syria. They besiege the capital city of the northern nation of Israel. So Ahab's got some big problems here. But then what happens? Verse 13. Meanwhile, a prophet came to Ahab, king of Israel, and announced, "This is what the Lord says. Do you see this vast army? I will give it into your hand today, and then you will know that I am Yahweh." Okay, you will know that I'm Yahweh. So God's reaching out to Ahab here. Here he's worshiping all these Baals and other gods, but Yahweh is reaching out to him saying, I want you to know that I am God so that you can worship me and you can lead my people into worship of me. And as a result, I'm going to give you this victory so that you will know that I am God. Because take a look at all these people. Is there any way you can defeat them? No. But I can defeat them for you. And so then what happens? Verse 21, the king of Israel advanced and overpowered the horses and chariots and inflicted heavy losses on the Arameans. So God gave Ahab a huge victory at Samaria against Ben-Hadad of Syria or of Aram and 32 kings that fought along with him, that were allies with him. Okay, big, big victory. And God brought that victory. And then not only that, God didn't stop there. Look at verse 26. Says, the next spring, Ben-Hadad mustered the Arameans and went to Aphek to fight against Israel again. And then verse 28, the man of God came up and told the king of Israel, told Ahab, this is what Yahweh says. Because the Arameans think that Yahweh is a god of the hills and not a god of the valleys, I will deliver this vast army into your hands and you will know that I am Yahweh. Okay, so he provides, and what happens in verse 29? For 7 days they camped opposite each other, and on the seventh day the battle was joined. The Israelites inflicted 100,000 casualties on the Aramean foot soldiers in one day. What a huge victory. And even listen to verse 30, the rest of them escaped to the city of Aphek, where the wall collapsed on 27,000 of them. And Ben-Hadad fled to the city and hidden in a room. So God gave him a great huge victory a second time. So now Ahab knows that Yahweh is God, right? Ahab knows it. God's proven it to him. But he doesn't follow through in faith. In fact, even under this case, his discernment, his recognition of God's will and God's plan falls short. And take a look how Ahab interfered with God's plan for these victories here. Verse 34. Ben-Hadad offered to Ahab. Ben-Hadad came to Ahab then after being defeated here, and he said, "Look, I will return the cities that my father took from your father, and you can set up your own market areas in Damascus as my father did in Samaria." Ahab said, "On the basis of a treaty, I'll set you free." So he made a treaty with him and let him go. So he let Ben-Hadad go. Well, what's the problem with that? Well, a lot of problems, but verse 42, we see that the prophet came to Ahab and he said, "This is what Yahweh says. You have set free a man that I had determined should die. Therefore, it's your life for his life, your people for his people." Okay? It was God's plan for Ahab. God brought Ahab, brought Ben-Hadad to him. And he had victory, and he could have easily taken over and brought all this peace. But he didn't. He let Ben-Hadad go and made this treaty. Ahab set him free. And as a result, God judges against him here. Okay. Now we also see that Ahab is the last one of the gray, dark, brown, dark, black, whatever colors here. Okay? That dark section talked about civil strife. So obviously Ahab did something to help end the civil strife between the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And he actually did a couple of things. Okay, we see in chapter 22, starting at verse 4. Well, let me start at verse 1. "For 3 years there was no war between Aram and Israel, but in the third year Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went down to see the king of Israel." So we start seeing some communication between the kings of Israel and Judah. "The king of Israel had said to his officials, 'Don't you know that Ramoth-Gilead belongs to us, and yet we're doing nothing to retake it from the king of Aram?' So he asked Jehoshaphat, 'Will you go with me to fight against Ramoth-Gilead?' Jehoshaphat replied to the king of Israel, 'I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses.' But Jehoshaphat also said to the king of Israel, 'But first, let's seek the counsel of Yahweh.'" And then, verse 29, we see the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead. So we see that Ahab had Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, join forces with him to go help him take care of this, recapture Ramoth-Gilead. Why would he do that? Well, part of that we continue to see in the next verse, 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 18. Which really comes a little later, but it's a sign of what was going on at this time. Verse 18 says, "He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel as the house of Ahab had done, for he married a daughter of Ahab. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord." And this is talking about Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat. So what happened is Jehoshaphat had his son Jehoram marry a daughter of Ahab, that is Athaliah, which that name will mean a lot to you when we talk about that next week, when we talk about the southern nation of Judah. Okay, so we see that the civil strife between the two nations breaks up because of Jehoshaphat and Ahab working together and even marrying their family, uniting their families together. What a horrible thing for Jehoshaphat to do. What a horrible thing to happen to the southern nation of Judah. Because what is this? This is the worst time in all in a relationship with God of all the history of the northern nation of Israel. And what happens then is that infiltrates and comes in and creates problems in the southern nation of Judah. And we'll talk about that next week. Now, there's an interesting story in chapter 21 called Naboth's Vineyard. And we won't go over that story, but we will touch on it a little bit because it does highlight how horrible of a person Jezebel was and how wimpy and spineless Ahab was in allowing Jezebel to make all these changes away from God and all of that. We see in chapter 21, starting in verse 2, that Ahab said to Naboth, "Let me have your vineyard to use it for a vegetable garden since it's close to my palace. In exchange, I'll give you a better vineyard, or if you prefer, I'll pay you whatever it's worth." But Naboth replied, "Yahweh forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." Okay, so there was this vineyard that was close to his palace, and Ahab wanted it. And it belonged to this guy named Naboth, and he said, "Hey, let me swap you some better land for that. Okay, let me make you a deal. Or let me buy it from you, whatever you want. You tell me the price, and I'll do it." So, you know, it sounds like, you know, that's an up-and-up thing. But land was always to stay in the family. And Naboth said, "That would not be right for me to give up my family's inheritance, my family's land, even if you gave me something better." So we then see, verse 4, Ahab went home sullen and angry because Naboth the Jezreelite had said, "I won't give it to you." He lay in his bed sulking and refused to eat. So there you get a picture of Ahab, okay, the kind of guy that he was. His wife Jezebel came in, then verse 5, and asked him, "Why are you so sullen? Why don't you eat?" He said, "Because I told Naboth that I wanted to buy his vineyard, and he said he won't sell it to me." Jezebel's wife said, "Is that how you act as king over Israel? Get up and eat. Cheer up. I'll get it for you. I'll get you the vineyard of Naboth, the Jezreelite." So she wrote letters in Ahab's name, placed a seal on them, and sent them to the elders and nobles. And she set up this ruse here. We see verse 11. "The elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city did as Jezebel directed in the letter she had written to them. They proclaimed a fast and seated Naboth in a prominent place among the people. And then two scoundrels came and sat opposite him and brought charges against Naboth before the people, saying, 'Naboth has cursed both God and the king.' So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death. Then they sent word to Jezebel, 'Naboth has been stoned and it's dead.' As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned to death, she said to Ahab, 'Get up and take the possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite that he refused to sell you. He's no longer alive, but dead.' When Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, he got up and went down to take possession of Naboth's vineyard." Okay. So there you see a big picture into those two people. And the kind of person Jezebel was, the kind of person Ahab was. Okay. All right. Well, Ahab, though, was the king. He was the one responsible. And he supported Jezebel. He supported this Baal worship, even though maybe it was Jezebel pushing it, but he was the one responsible. So what judgment did God then have against Ahab? Chapter 21, starting at verse 17 through verse 24. "And the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite." Now we see here's Elijah entering the scene. "Go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, who rules in Samaria. He's now in Naboth's vineyard where he's gone to take possession of it. Say to him, 'This is what Yahweh says. Have you not murdered a man and seized his property?' Or then say to him, 'This is what Yahweh says. In the place where dogs licked up Naboth's blood, dogs will lick up your blood. Yes, yours.' Ahab said to Elijah, 'So you found me, my enemy?' 'I found you,' he answered, 'because you have sold yourself to do evil in the eyes of Yahweh. I'm going to bring disaster on you. I will consume your descendants and cut off from Ahab every last male in Israel, slave or free. I'll make your house like that of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, or like Baasha, son of Ahijah.'" Okay, and what happened to both of those? He wiped out those families entirely, right? "Because you have provoked me to anger and have caused Israel to sin. And also concerning Jezebel, Yahweh says, 'Dogs will devour Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel. Dogs will eat those belonging to Ahab who die in the city, and birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country.'" Okay? So, quite a judgment there. His family would be wiped out, just like that of Jeroboam and Baasha. So there are no more Ahabites, okay? No more descendants of Ahab around, or Jezebel around, okay? Because of what gets prescribed. And we'll see how that gets carried out as we go on. But look, he's got dogs will lick up his blood. Dogs will eat Jezebel, okay? So quite a bit. So let's see, how does all that get carried out? 1 Kings chapter 22, verses 37 to 38. "So the king died, Okay, the king that is Ahab. Now he was in battle at Ramoth Gilead, we see in the verses before, and he died in battle and was brought to Samaria and they buried him there. They washed the chariot at a pool in Samaria where the prostitutes bathed, and the dogs licked up his blood there as the word of Yahweh had declared. Okay, so there we see the dogs licking up Ahab's blood, just as Elijah had said would happen. And then go back further to 2 Kings chapter 9, starting at verse 24. Jehu drew his bow and shot Joram between the shoulders. The arrow pierced his heart, and he slumped down in his chariot. Jehu said to Bidkar, his chariot officer, pick him up and throw him on that field that belonged to Naboth the Jezreelite. Remember how you and I were riding together in the chariots behind Ahab his father when the Lord made this prophecy about him, that yesterday I saw the blood of Naboth and the blood of his sons, declares the Lord, and I will surely make you pay for it on this plot of ground, declares the Lord. Now then, pick him up and throw him on that plot in accordance with the word of the Lord. So Jehu killed Joram, okay, Ahab's son, okay, who was king of Israel at the time. Jehu was a commander in Israel's army and was called by God to be the next king. And so he goes and he kills Joram and throws his body in Naboth's field where dogs would lick up the blood, and that confirms the prophecy as before. Okay, and then verse 30, this is interesting. Then Jehu went to Jezreel. When Jezebel heard about it, she painted her eyes, arranged her hair, and looked out of a window. As Jehu entered the gate, she asked, have you come in peace, Zimri, you murderer of your master? Okay, so you see the derogatory name that Jezebel throws at Jehu by calling him Zimri. Okay, Zimri was the one who assassinated the King Jeroboam's son before. He looked up at the window and called out, who's on my side? Who? Two or three eunuchs looked down at him. Throw her down, Jehu said. So they threw her down, and some of her blood splattered the wall and the horses as they trampled her underfoot. Okay, so she's killed here. Jehu went in and ate and drank, and he said, hey, take care of that cursed woman and bury her, for she is a king's daughter. But when they went out to bury her, they found nothing except her skull, her feet, and her hands. They went back and told Jehu, who said, well, this is the word of the Lord that he spoke through his servant Elijah the Tishbite. On the plot of ground at Jezreel, dogs will devour Jezebel's flesh. Jezebel's body will be like refuse on the ground in the plot of Jezreel, so that no one will be able to say, this is Jezebel. So that's what happened to her, just as Elijah had foretold. And then it doesn't finish there, because there are other descendants, there are other relatives of Ahab, and we see them taken care of in chapter 10. Jehu wrote, I'll start at verse 6. Jehu wrote a second letter saying, if you're on my side and will obey me, take the heads of your master's sons and come to me in Jezreel by this time tomorrow. Now the royal princes, 70 of them, were with the leading men of the city who were rearing them. When the letters arrived, these men took the princes and slaughtered all 70 of them. They put their heads in baskets and sent them to Jehu in Jezreel. When the messengers arrived, he told Jehu, they brought the heads of the princes. Okay, so all the princes, all the sons and descendants of Ahab, sons and grandsons here were killed off. And then verse 10, know then that not a word that the Lord has spoken against the house of Ahab will fail. Yahweh has done what he promised through his servant Elijah. So Jehu killed everyone in Jezreel who remained of the house of Ahab, as well as all of his chief men, his close friends, and his priests, leaving him no survivors. And then verse 14, Then Jehu set out and went toward Samaria. At Beth-Aked of the shepherds, he met some relatives of Ahaziah, king of Judah, and asked, who are you? Oh, we're relatives of Ahaziah, and we've come down to greet the families of the king and the queen mother. Take him alive, he ordered. So they took him alive and slaughtered them by the wall of Beth-Aked. 42 men, he left no survivor. Okay, Ahaziah, they were relatives, and they were descendants of Ahab there. So you see then that Jehu wiped them all out here, okay? Just as God had said would happen through Elijah. All right, one more thing. What other prophecy was fulfilled with Ahab's death? Back to 1 Kings chapter 22, verse 12. All the other prophets were prophesying the same thing. Okay, this is when This is when Jehoshaphat was with Ahab, and we read the verses at the beginning of chapter 22 where he asked Jehoshaphat, will you go with me to fight against Ramoth Gilead? And Jehoshaphat said, sure, you know, my people are your people and I'm here to help you. But verse 5, he said, first seek the counsel of the Lord. So they brought together all these prophets. Okay. Ahab brought together his prophets. What kind of prophets? Well, they wouldn't be Yahweh prophets. They were Baal prophets. And he brought together these prophets. And verse 12, it says, all these prophets were prophesying the same thing. Attack Ramoth Gilead and be victorious, for Yahweh will give it into the king's hand. All right. And then 19, we see that there was this other prophet named Micaiah, who really was a prophet of Yahweh. He said, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne with all the host of heaven standing around him on his right and on his left. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab into attacking Ramoth Gilead and going to his death there? Well, one suggested this and another that. Finally, a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I'll entice him. By what means, the Lord asked, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouths of all of his prophets. You'll succeed in enticing him, said the Lord. Go and do it. And then verse 34, we see then, so he then goes into battle. He believes his other prophets and not Micaiah. He goes into battle. We see that someone drew his bow at random and hit the king of Israel between the sections of his armor. The king told his chariot driver, wheel around and get me out of the fighting. I've been wounded. In verse 7, the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried him there. So Micaiah had prophesied that disaster here, and had prophesied that Ahab would die in battle, and sure enough, that's what happened here. Okay? So that's the story of Ahab at the bottomless time, the worst time of Israel's history here. Okay, at this, we are now done with page 4. We've got 4 more pages that will actually probably go a little bit quicker, but we'll separate this into 2 recordings. So I'm going to stop this recording here. You can go take a break and then come back for the second recording to cover pages 5 through 8 or 5 through 9. Okay?